A podcast of the cinema.
Hosted by me, the water drinkingest man in town. My name is Dave White. I'm a film critic for the Wrap sometimes. Not all the time, but sometimes. Recently, what did I just review recently for the Wrap?
God's Not Dead 3.
Yeah, that BS. But something else.
Ismail's Ghosts.
Ismail's Ghosts. Yeah. And you, what's your name?
I'm Alonzo Duraldi. I'm senior, film reviews editor at The Wrap. I am a co-host of the Who Shot You podcast on Maximum Fun and of the What the Flick show on the Young Turks Network on YouTube. So, and Dave was trying to make me laugh with his goofy water drinking, and I was trying to make him laugh with my dead-eyed stare. So,
these are the things that you cannot see.
Yes,
on a podcast,
really, really comes to life in an audio program. But
I'm just so thirsty.
Well, maybe because I just ate three sandwiches.
I did. I was at a friend's going away party. A friend is leaving the country.
Yes. I did not attend because I'm researching a special thing that is happening soon.
He's Australian anyway.
The friend.
So, like, and he's off to Berlin. So, you know. He's a globetrotter.
He's the continental.
He's been living here for a long time, though. And the party was in the neighborhood. And the food was catered.
By whom?
I don't know. But the sandwiches
were
delicious.
You ate three sandwiches and didn't bother to find out where they were from?
Oh, wait, I'm sorry. Okay, no. The sandwiches were from Le Pain Quotidien.
Oh, okay.
Which, that's not how anyone says it.
No.
Le Pain Quotidien.
Yeah.
But I was shocked.
They can't call it the daily bread. It has to be Le Pain Quotidien.
I was shocked because the bread was so good.
So it was not quotidian?
No. I really thought it was from someplace fancier than that. Because the bread was so good. Like, I have eaten at that place once, and when I walked out of there, I just thought, okay, that was fine.
Yeah. I have a shrug when I think of it.
But these were, whoa. They were astoundingly good sandwiches with, like, this crispy, crusty bread that wasn't the kind, like, the crust was really hard. But it was still sandwichy, and you could bite through it. It didn't wrestle with your mouth or shred the roof of your mouth. Or
stab you with shards of crust. Okay.
Yeah. It was, oh, so delicious.
And they were made of salt?
Like, it makes me want to go back there and say, give me that sandwich I had it at Carl's party.
And they'll be like, oh, yes, that one.
Yeah. Maybe they'll remember.
I doubt it.
Maybe not. But, you know, they were full of saltiness, so I had to come home and drink this whole bottle of water in front of you.
Great.
And now you're on your own for dinner.
Apparently, you didn't cross your mind to maybe, like, bring a sandwich home.
I'm not going to walk out of a catered party with food under my arm. I mean, I would. But
I wouldn't want it under your arm either.
A warm spring day. I didn't have a bag with me to cart home the food.
You say my husband loves you and sorry he couldn't make your going away party.
I did tell him. I said Alonzo says,
but he deserves a delicious sandwich.
I told him Alonzo says goodbye forever.
Not quite the message I would have imparted.
He's sad to report that he's working this afternoon and cannot go to this party, and therefore he will never see you again. These are the things I said to him.
He's a globetrotter. We'll see. He's coming back. We'll see his like again.
He's coming back.
Yes,
someday. But no, there was no. I mean, like it felt rude to just like scoop up a bunch of food and take it out?
Well, a bunch of food, one sandwich after you've already eaten three of them.
I would look, if it had been a fancy something something kind of party where I didn't know a bunch of people, I'd have been shoving food into my pockets and I wouldn't have cared.
Yeah, you know a bunch of people who know that you have a husband who is not with you at this party and maybe would have enjoyed a nice sandwich that had already clearly gotten the thumbs up from you thrice.
Listen, I am, if nothing else in this life, I am etiquette.
You are selfish.
So well-mannered and well-bred
that
I cannot be the kind of lout.
You were raised by coyotes.
I was. I'm not going to be the kind of lout who just carts up a whole armful of sandwiches.
Think of all those times. Think of I endured the Chocolat premiere. And brought.
That's exactly what I'm talking about.
And I brought you back Chocolat.
That's exactly what I'm talking about. A place where it doesn't matter if you just like open up a bag, like a backpack, and just start shoving things in and waltz out and go, later, suckers, this movie was poop.
Look,
that is a fine place.
You could have put a sandwich and a napkin and be like, I'm bringing it home for Alonzo, who's working very hard right now to free me up to attend occasions like this.
Listen, when we're done podcasting, as it is late on a Sunday afternoon,
mm-hmm.
I'm going to heat up the last of them pot stickers that are in the fridge.
Mm-hmm.
Or you can just have a big bowl of cereal, whatever you want. Listen. The sky's the limit.
Yeah, but you know, all I can
anything for my husband.
All I can think about.
You can do anything you want.
Apparently,
for dinner.
These amazing sandwiches.
God, they were so good. Did I tell you I had three of them?
Yes. Pig. And you didn't bring a fourth one home to me. So thanks for nothing, Dave White.
Okay, sure, fine, whatever. Here I am offering to cook you up some pot stickers. Yeah.
Don't even. It's too little too late.
I'm fine. I have no regrets. Next time we're at a big...
In the words of Pat Benatar, it's a little too little, a little too late. That was Pat Benatar, right?
It was. Okay. I just have never known you to care enough about Pat Benatar to mention anything about...
Really?
Her.
You better run, you better hide. Because love is a battlefield.
All right. Fine.
We belong to the night.
We have good news.
What's that?
We have good news for the listeners. We're going to review 5 movies.
Mm-hmm.
We're not going to dawdle. Spend it too long on any one film.
Especially since two of them are ones you'll probably never get a chance to see.
That's not true.
In your local
that
cinema.
That is not true. You don't know these things for a fact.
I said probably.
But all 5 of them are good.
Hmm.
There's not a dud in the bunch this week.
Of course, that's because we're being selective. Like... We didn't go see...
Well, okay, we didn't go see the volleyball movie.
Exactly.
We didn't go see the Christian volleyball movie starring Helen Hunt.
Right. Oscar winner Helen Hunt.
Can someone explain to me why Helen Hunt feels the need to be in this film?
Maybe Helen Hunt isn't getting a lot of offers.
I think Helen Hunt does whatever the hell Helen Hunt wants to do.
Well, whatever the Helen Hunt.
Yeah.
Maybe she thought this was a, you know, there aren't a lot of movies about girls' high school athletics. Maybe she thought...
I suppose that's true.
She was being very right-on woman.
But how does any actor who knows anything approach one of these faith-based scripts and think, no, this one's going to be good? All the rest of them have been inept crap. But this one's
going to be
because I'm saying yes to this project. This one's not going to taste like the floor of a public bus.
Well, I mean, look, we haven't seen the movie, so we can't say. But
listen, I haven't seen the movie, and I'm never going to see this movie, and I can tell you right now, it stinks. How about that?
Fine.
Oh, I've amassed quite a reputation and of credibility on this subject. And it is a super curve that you grade these movies on.
Right.
If it ain't Pasolini's The Gospel According to St. Matthew, you can get the F out of here. How you like that? Cash me outside.
Oh, come on. That scene is not true. You liked Miracles from Heaven.
No. Don't put words in my face.
Sorry. Did I get it twisted?
I liked Jennifer Garner's performance in Miracles from Heaven. And I said that it was more thoughtful than it could have otherwise been.
I see.
Yeah. For a film about people who believe that God threw their child out of a tree and bonked her head and cured her of her illness.
Right.
Okay. All right.
But the movie also allows for the possibility that God had nothing to do with it, which most of these movies do not.
Okay. Like a millimeter, yeah.
Okay, fine.
Yeah.
It's like grading on the Tyler Perry scale. And we didn't see Chappaquiddick, which I've heard kind of mixed about. Like I've heard more good about it than I would have
zero
expected.
Interest.
That's the thing.
And I'm just
interest.
Not doing it.
Yeah.
Like, let's have a good idea. Let's leave this family alone.
For starters.
And by that, I don't mean let's have a hands-off policy toward them.
Yeah.
They are public people, after all.
Yes.
And therefore, their lives are open for discussion. But why are they the only family we discuss? Why do we keep going back to the well of these folks? Except for Grey Gardens, I'm done with all of them.
Because Jason Clarke really wanted to do that accent, I suppose.
Yeah, everybody wants to do that accent.
Yeah.
We didn't see that, and we didn't see that. So what we did see was Blockers, A Quiet Place.
Yes.
You saw You Were Never Really Here. Mm-hmm. I need to catch up on it, so we're going to do that next week.
Yes.
We both saw Lean on Pete.
Yep.
And I saw Claire's Camera and a documentary called Good Luck.
Those were both of the Locarno something?
No.
Something?
No. No. I'll explain when we get to them. Why don't we talk about A Quiet Place as best we can?
Sure.
I
fear already that this movie is being oversold.
How so?
I liked it. I think it's effective in a lot of ways. It has a gimmick that it exploits in a very clever way. That said, I think its pleasures are small and they are being inflated artificially by some critic.
Do you think so?
I think so.
Okay, well.
But the basic premise, as you know from the poster, if they hear you, they hunt you. So there's been some sort of
monster's going to get you.
Horrible monsters that have wiped out humanity for the most part.
They're aliens.
And a family led by John Krasinski and Emily Blunt, who are married in real life, and their children are surviving as best they can by being as quiet as they can. And so...
How much can we say?
I think I'm going to skirt around
the edges of things. We're not going to spoil things.
Yeah.
All right.
I think...
Because for this movie, in spite of the fact that I don't believe in spoilers, for this one, I kind of do believe in spoilers.
All right. Is it a spoiler to say...
You're asking me on the mic. Ask.
Well, I'm not going to say what I'm going to say, obviously, but...
Yeah.
Oh, fine. I won't spoil anything. Don't worry about it.
Okay.
Anyway, so obviously this is a movie that is built on, foundationally built on the idea of silence. And that you have to completely rethink everything you do in life to do it quietly.
Right.
Which is a cool idea, and the theater that we saw it in, and I hear this is the thing in a lot of theaters, everybody shuts up.
Oh, yeah.
Everybody is very quiet.
We saw it in a sold-out theater on Thursday night in the early screenings, and
you could hear a pin drop.
The film has the power. And this is one of the reasons why I think it's so cool.
Yes.
The film itself forces you to be silent along with the characters. Otherwise, you're the ruiner of the movie.
Exactly.
Like, I got so conscious about my own breathing during this movie and about the fact that I had a soda with me. So anytime there was a noisy part or music, the score kicked in, that's when I would take a sip of my soda.
And that...
I was timing it to the noises.
That is part of my problem with the movie.
Okay.
The score. There shouldn't be one.
There shouldn't be one.
There shouldn't be one.
Okay.
I think that this is a movie that needs to own itself and not be afraid of being quiet.
Right.
And so when there is score, it's like, like you're violating the very essence of what this story is supposed to be.
In principle, I agree with you, but in its effect, the score did not really bother me at all.
Okay. Well, I was annoyed by that.
Okay.
And then there are some really effective sort of set pieces. There are some interesting ideas that weave their way through. It is a well-told story. There were two writers that have story credit, and then they and Krasinski, who directed, share screenplay credit.
So they wrote it, and then he came in and put his thumbs all over it and said, mine!
I'm sure something along those lines, yeah. Probably. Thank you, Writers Guild.
I'm just guessing.
Yeah,
We don't know. Maybe they all three sat down together over an amiable lunch and hammered out their points.
And maybe they had delicious sandwiches.
Maybe they had each of them three
and John
delicious
Krasinski
sandwiches.
Was probably considerate enough to bring one home
for
to
Emily Blunt.
Because he was thinking about her needs.
Maybe.
Anyway, when we were walking home, you were like, okay, this, and then this, and then this, and you rather rightly pointed out things that don't necessarily stand up as red flags while you're watching the movie, but the second you start thinking about it, you're like, hey.
But that conversation that we had did not, the fact that I was bringing up all of these, but what about, and then what about, and then what about,
and why would they?
And why would they? Yeah. That didn't diminish my pleasure.
Okay.
Again, so it's not the kind of movie I can see again, because it's just my questions will only be amplified
the second time around. I'm in no way slagging this movie. It's entertaining. It is effective at what it wants to do. It fulfills its sort of, mission statement as a horror movie.
Yeah.
But I think there are a few people who are already going a little nuts about how great it is. And it's very good.
I think it's very good. And I had a really great time.
Yeah. And I will say this, I'm sorry. No, go ahead.
No, continue. Okay. Finish what you were going to say.
What I was going to say was, in the last few years, there have been different ways in which movies have made themselves experiences that had to be had in a movie theater.
Yes.
And there was, for a while it was 3D. And then you had, Gravity came along. It was like, no, you have to see this in the theater. You have to see it, ideally in 70, but you have to see it in the theater because otherwise it doesn't have the same oomph.
Impact, right.
This is one of those movies.
I'd say so.
You need to be in a dark room with people and all of you being silent and everyone's phone off and all that stuff for it to really deliver in the way that it can.
That was one of the more shocking things of this film is that our packed house, our sold out theater,
behaved.
Not a phone, nothing. Mm. Nothing. And I wasn't even like, after the first 5 minutes, I thought, someone's going to muck this up. But nobody did.
Yeah.
Now, here's what I like, and I'm going to try to talk around it. But as we said, it's a film about a family who have survived this alien invasion. And have done so by virtue of the fact that they were already practiced in the art of quiet communication because their daughter is deaf.
Played by Millicent Simmons from Wonderstruck.
Yes. And she herself is a young deaf actress. One of the cool things about the scenario is, oh, you lived because you already had... Because
you spoke ASL.
You spoke sign with each other already.
Yeah.
Which I thought was a
cool twist.
A cool little, detail. I also really liked how attractive their life still felt to me.
Because it was cozy.
It was a cozy sort of artisanal lifestyle that mm-hmm. they were leading.
Very upstate New York.
Yeah.
Lots of quilts.
Yeah. And, you know, a lot of everything's soft and padded, so you don't make noises. Mm.
I didn't read the article. There was an article online that says, wouldn't they wear socks? Because they go barefoot for the whole movie, too.
Right.
For extreme quietness.
Right.
And it's like, maybe not. Maybe if they get wet, better to be barefoot.
I will tell you a thing about old wood floors in old buildings. We live in an apartment that was built in the 50s, probably. Mm-hmm. And the floors are wood, and they creak.
Yeah.
We got the creakiest floors in this apartment. If I am walking around in this apartment in bare feet, I creak more than if I am wearing socks. Because if I'm wearing socks, I can glide.
Right.
Yeah. Also, those floors in that old house that they live in mm-hmm. must be made of like the hardest wood imaginable because that house has a good 30 years on this apartment and their floors don't creak all that much, like at all. Like they step from thing to thing, like they have little painted spots on the floor
right,
because to let you know where the non-creak area is
because the deaf.
But eventually, it's going to start creaking in that little paint spot too.
Because the deaf daughter, while she gives the family the advantage of knowing ASL, she herself cannot hear
if she's making noise. Right.
The son, by the way, is played by Noah Jupe, who is a young actor. I think is really terrific. He's the friend in Wonder, and he was the son in the otherwise terrible Suburbicon.
Oh, I didn't see Suburbicon.
Don't.
I'm not going to. I liked how this looked. I liked how it moved. It was so suspenseful
yes.
throughout.
No, I was eating my hand
yeah.
for so much of this movie.
There is so much of this film's running time that involves you holding your breath. Mm. Not because you want to stay quiet for them, although that is sort of a weird effect of the film.
Yeah.
But because you're worried about what's coming next. I guess I like it better than you because I really think it's great.
No, I like it quite a bit. Yeah. I think I made the mistake of sort of being online this weekend and I think people are going a little over the top for it. But no, I heartily recommend it. You should totally see it. See it in a theater. Shut your phone off. All that stuff.
Yeah, you better. No vibrate.
Yeah.
No vibrating phones. Turn it off.
I did not see Krasinski's first film as a director.
Which one was that?
It was like Conversations with Odious Men or something. I forget the title of it. It's based on a novel.
Right.
I want to say it's based on like a David Foster Wallace novel.
Maybe.
Anyway, I did see.
He seems like the type to think he's literary.
Yeah, I did. I did see The Hollers, which was terrible.
I never saw that.
You know how we talked about how like on paper. Other people feels like a million Sundance movies about
yeah.
people going home because their mom is dying.
Yes.
The Hollers is one of those.
Is movies. That movie.
Yeah.
Got it. Having said all of this, the aliens would eat me alive within moments. I sneeze because I have terrible allergies and you can't, you know.
Muffle.
You can't muffle that. You could try, but you still make a little noise. I snore.
Yes. Yes, you do.
Also, listen. Sometimes I have nightmares. Like, I have regular nightmares.
That too.
And when I have a nightmare, every month or so when I have my nightmare, I wake up yelling. Because
yes.
that's how my nightmare always goes. I wake up yelling, and I would wake up from my nightmare to be eaten by an alien.
Yeah, and then I, having been quiet all this time...
Would also be eaten.
Would get eaten because of your...
Nightmare.
Scary pants nightmares.
Right.
So thanks a lot, Dave White.
I'm sorry.
For killing me. Oh, a thing I want to talk about, in addition to our movies this week.
What?
The essay that Molly Ringwald wrote in The New Yorker.
Yes.
About John Hughes and 16 Candles and The Breakfast Club.
It's a really good article, and it is
a great sort of piece of, I don't want to say necessarily, I mean, it's cultural criticism, but I think it's about,
it's also self-examination.
Yeah, exactly. It's, it's about a thing that we all do, which is to sort of look back at the, our favorites of our youth and kind of figure out, oh God, what was this saying at the time and how does it hold up now? But from the point of view of somebody who was participatory.
Right.
You know, and
like, what do you do when you helped create the thing that is beloved and also now considered
a problematic,
in the creative. Words of the kids, problematic.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, you watch 16 Candles and you may love 16 Candles, but there's no denying that there are some things going on in 16 Candles.
Yeah.
It's just aren't good.
It's racist and rapey.
Yeah.
And it's also a lot of wonderful things as well. And that's the crux of this article, where she talks about, like, now that her kids are old enough to watch these movies and talking about them, those movies with them. And of all the discussion of the past year or so involving sort of, you know,
context and the era of something's production.
Exactly.
And, you know, can you sift through what's wrong with a work of art to find what's right with it?
Exactly.
And
keeping the wrong from blocking the right.
And what about, you know, when you start assuming that you have the answer about this thing and you start talking to other people who have experienced it, who should be offended by it and who aren't.
Yeah.
And other people who participated in it and who still think that everything about it is fine.
And she goes back and looks at like Hughes's Lampoon work.
Right.
Which I thought was really interesting, because no one's really, you know, the stuff that I've read about him, people only sort of glancingly refer to his National Lampoon work. I mean, apart from obviously the stories that inspired the Vacation movies,
right,
the things that were sort of directly adapted, but he was an editor there. Like, he worked there for a long time and he contributed a lot of material. And she actually kind of starts digging up some of that stuff and talking about, like, what do we think about this? And
right,
where is this coming from? And how does this jibe with the person that I knew and with the work that he was, that we did together, and what I thought he was trying to say, and his sort of sensitivity about these topics, but then his insensitivity about these other topics. And
yeah.
It is, I very highly recommend that y'all go read it. We posted a link on the Linoleum Knife Facebook page. But yeah, I just think this is an ongoing conversation, but I think this is a really valuable contribution to that conversation.
And she is so wise about her place in the culture.
Yes.
And has had all this time now to sort of stand back and see, stand back and stand away from the phenomenon that she personally was,
right,
in the 80s, and who, a person who then sort of
stepped back,
deliberately stepped back,
yeah,
from it, moved off to France.
Mm-hmm.
And who now has this really interesting perspective, not only on her own work, but on, you know, the culture that she helped sort of create.
Yeah.
Back then. I just remember, and I remember her being this way because, I mean, we are in age.
She's my age.
We are peers. Yeah, we're the same generation. And I remember from the time she was like 16, mm-hmm, and I was 18, 19, and reading about her, reading interviews with her, and thinking, she's different from other actors, because there are so many actors who think of their job as, I go in, I play the part, I have no opinions, I don't have to know about things outside of this. This is just my job, and I'm not, don't look to me for anything interesting to come out of my mouth if I'm not playing a role.
If somebody didn't write it for me.
Right. She was never like that. Mm. She always had opinions and ideas, and she said them out loud in ways that often, that rankled people sometimes and caused her to be sort of dismissed by Hughes after a moment. Like, they had a falling out.
Right.
And later in life, they reconciled, apparently. Mm-hmm. But she became, you know, vocal about her opinions about where she wanted things to go with their collaborations. And he was like, no. And he held a grudge.
Yeah.
And then later, you know, in life, you see, like, later in her life, in her 20s and 30s and 40s, she'd pop up in an interview here or there and have more things to say, and you'd think, oh, you really are smart and cool, yeah. And you know the things that I, that, you know the things I know. You know what I mean?
We need to get her book.
We see, the kind of person, if you were in a small town, and you met them, you'd think, okay, we're friends.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
We have cultural affinities.
Not that I think I'm so smart and cool, but I mean, like, she saw the world the way I was seeing the world.
Absolutely.
At that time.
Yeah.
And so I've always admired her. I've always thought she was great. And this article is proof that I was right.
Yeah, I mean, I was semi-obsessed with her during her moment of fame. And it was in that way that young gay boys are, you know?
Well, yeah. Yeah. Because there were no young gay boys in the 80s saying what we needed to hear.
Right.
There were avatars.
Exactly.
And she was one of them.
Yeah, no. That's one of the reasons that I love Simon the way I do, is because watching that ending gave me the same chills that the ending of 16 Candles always gave me as a kid, but without having to do the translating work, you know?
Right.
And yeah, she's great. She's amazing, and y'all should read this piece.
Let's talk about Lean on Pete.
Ooh.
Speaking of a film where the ending will choke you up.
I saw this last August September at the Venice Film Festival, and it is the fourth feature film from Andrew Haig.
Yeah.
Best known for
forgot about the first one.
Yeah, Greek Pete did not get a giant release.
Yeah.
It's a bit of a curiosity.
Right.
It doesn't entirely sort of herald what he would become as a filmmaker.
No, not at all.
He is best known for Weekend and 45 Years and for his contributions to the HBO show Looking.
Yeah.
This is his first feature film shot in America. Obviously, you know, he'd been in San Francisco doing Looking. But there is a school of films made by Europeans working in the United States for the first time where they love the space.
Yeah.
And they love the tragedy.
Right.
In my review, I referred to American miserableism.
Why don't you talk about the plot? Like, what happens?
Sure. Okay.
To make it American and miserable?
So, there's a teenage boy named Charlie, who's played by Charlie Plummer, who played the kidnapped Getty in All the Money in the World.
Yeah.
He and his father moved to Portland, Oregon, but not sort of not the hipster voodoo donuts Portland, Oregon, but the wrong side of the tracks of Portland, Oregon.
I thought that was just an expression. Then I saw there are real tracks.
he strikes up a friendship with Steve Buscemi, who runs a horse stable, and winds up going to work for him and taking care of this aging racehorse named Lean on Pete. Everyone tells him not to get too attached to the horse, because after a certain age, when the horses can't really run the races anymore, they get sent down to Mexico, which is that's where they can be sort of legally slaughtered, basically.
Yeah.
And so, despite having grown closer to Buscemi and to a jockey played by Chloe Sevigny, eventually Charlie steals away the horse and tries to liberate it. And also, during all this, his father has gotten mixed up with a married woman and wound up in the hospital. And so he's trying to find his estranged aunt, who the father sort of drove out of their lives, but who's always sort of been there for Charlie. And so much of the movie is the boy and the horse making their way across the...
From Oregon to Wyoming.
Yeah, the merciless American desert and across the highways and in further and further dire situations.
Oh, my.
And it's upsetting. It's a gut-wrenching movie, but it is also a very... I think it is ultimately a humane film, but it puts you through the ringer.
Upsetting and gut-wrenching, weirdly, are words I might not use.
Really?
To describe it, even though my stomach and my heart were twisted in knots, I was definitely upset in a few spots while watching it.
You later told me you were having a panic attack.
I was kind of mostly having a panic attack through the whole thing. Because it is a film about all the things you said it was about. It's about the landscape and the space. And I'm a British person. And is he British or Irish?
I think British.
Okay. And I'm here in America, and it's so big and huge. And look at all that space and the sky and the flat land. And, you know, there is that visual stuff going on.
Yeah.
But it is used in such an effective way because against this landscape is this tiny, skinny, helpless speck of a boy.
Yeah.
Who is, what, 16?
Yeah.
And who is without anyone. So just helpless, absolutely helpless. Although he's incredibly resourceful as a character. Like, he scrapes through to get the things he needs to get where he needs to go. It reminded me in many ways, in tone, mm-hmm. of Steven Soderbergh's King of the Hill, Wendy and Lucy.
Absolutely.
From Kelly Reichardt. And that fear that you feel for those characters in those films, mm-hmm. is the same kind of fear that you feel for this boy, because he's figured out a way to tell himself the story that it's not as bad as it is.
Right.
At one point, he runs into a homeless man played by Steve Zahn. Mm. And Steve Zahn calls him homeless. And he says, "I'm not homeless." And Steve Zahn says, "I hate to break it to you, but you are homeless." And then terrible things happen. But
I was also reminded, I mentioned Wendy and Lucy in my original review, as well as the 400 Blows, but also...
And the 400 Blows, where there are like literal shots that are
mirrored here. But I was reminded of a movie you liked more than I did, American Honey, and also Werner Herzog's Stroszek.
Yes.
In terms of that sort of Lost in America quality.
Right.
Of, you know, this land of opportunity, but also this land of unrelenting horror for people who are sort of, you know, strapped financially and untethered in the world.
There's a scene that reminded me of Maurice Pialat's L'Enfance Nue, where he makes himself feel better by, along this long, long, long journey, by just, he talks to the horse.
Yeah.
And at one point, the first time I cried in this film, and I may get choked up saying it out loud, he's talking to the horse and he says, like, "When we get to Aunt Margie's, maybe she'll let us stay if we behave ourselves." And I was like, oh God, please. Please find Aunt Margie. Because, you know, Aunt Margie has disappeared. We don't know where she is. And all he has is like the vaguest clue as to where he might find her. And for the rest of the movie, I was like, oh God, you have to please find Aunt Margie. Like, I don't care what else happens. And it's a good thing I thought to myself, I don't care what else happens, because else happens. So it really puts you through the ringer.
Yeah.
It is the most emotionally, like, wrecking experience I've had in a film in I don't even know how long. I wasn't depressed when it was over, but I was tired. Like, it made me feel like...
You'd been through something.
It made me feel like I had been through this journey. And that is, I believe, a testament to Andrew Haig, because he has so much compassion and empathy for this child.
Yeah.
And how... And I say child because even though he's 16 and very much a man,
yeah,
at this point in his life, because life has forced him to be that person, he reacts.
He needs to be taken care of.
He reacts to things in this very fragile way where, you know, no one has been taking care of him and somebody needs to come take care of him right now. It is, it's so beautiful.
Yeah. And
I...
Plummer is...
Please see this film.
Yeah. Charlie Plummer, I watched this whole movie thinking, wow, where did Andrew Haig find
this kid,
non-actor?
Because no, he's been in a million things.
He's been in a million things. Yeah. He was like, you know, I had not seen All the Money in the World yet. He was on Boardwalk Empire. But he gives the kind of great performance that you usually only get from people who've never been in front of a movie camera before.
Right.
Like the kind of people who are in a Sean Baker movie.
Yeah, yeah.
It's that, yes, kind of performance.
And it very much reminds me of the Florida Project in that sense of, like, falling through space. And there's
no floor.
There's nothing that's going to catch you.
Yeah.
And you're doomed. Or at least all hope seems lost.
Yes.
Yeah. I have one warning for people who want to see this film, who think they might want to see this very worthwhile film. If, how do I say this without giving things away?
If you have a problem with watching animals being put through a hard time.
A very hard time.
Yeah.
Yeah. That is a thing here.
Yeah.
So, okay. Yeah.
But go see it. Yeah. It's great.
I'm just shaking it off again. I saw it yesterday, so it's all still, it's still fresh in me. It's still making me feel all like I might cry again. Yeah, anxious.
I know this, you'll think this is fighting words, but a movie that is this genuine calls up for me how phony something like War Horse is.
Well, I saw this yesterday with Mr. Gary Cotty.
Mm-hmm.
Who, by the way, was absolutely silent as we walked out of the theater until we got to the car. And I have permission to tell this story.
Oh, okay.
Breaks down sobbing the minute we get in the car.
Wow.
And he was like, oh God, I'm so sad. Like, he just starts crying. And turn your damn phone off. I can hear it buzzing from here. Dang. What if we were in a quiet place right now and your phone was doing that?
Well, I turned my phone off at a quiet place. All the way.
Do it for your professional career of podcasting as well, won't you?
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
All the meeing and bang of your devices.
I'm making sure right now that mine is turned down as well. It's not. Mine's all my volume's all the way up.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
Anyway, yeah, when it was over, I said, so what can I talk about on the show? He's like, just tell me anything. I don't care. Where was I going with
War
this
Horse
story? Oh, War Horse is it's an entirely different film.
Yeah,
War Horse is a nostalgia spectacle.
Right.
And my love of War Horse is all about my love of being played by Steven Spielberg.
Gotcha.
Because he knows how to play you.
True.
And it's
he knows how to Ready Player One.
It's manipulative. But I was in it. I was I was ready for that.
I hear
with
you.
War Horse.
Okay.
I didn't know what I was getting into with this film.
Wow.
And it's so tender and real, mm-hmm, and not phony.
Yeah. No,
the experience is something completely different.
I went into it. I mean, I when I see films at festivals, if I can not know anything, like, you know, I told the story about Venice. Like, I went into The Shape of Water with no idea what it was about. I went into Downsizing thinking that it was literally going to be a movie about Matt Damon, you know, losing his job.
Right.
So, yeah, it's nice to have that opportunity to, like, walk into a theater with no clue of what you're about to see, or, you know, with no sort of pre-response to it, and just, like, let it unfold.
And I just had IMDb confirm something for me.
Yes.
Regarding an actor in this film. An Australian actor named Travis Fimmel, who plays the,
yes,
the ne'er-do-well father.
Right.
Every once in a while, I would hear something not American slip through in his voice.
Okay.
And I'd go, are you Irish? Like, where are you from?
What is Fimmel best known for under that name?
You're doing something. He's on the show Vikings, which makes perfect sense. Because he's got that Viking beardo kind of look. He's been in a lot of Australian television.
Okay.
He was in The Experiment. He was in...
Oh, right, that one. Okay.
Yeah. You know, he's been in a lot of... He was in Warcraft. Anyway, every once in a while I'd hear something in his voice and I'd go,
where are you from?
Where are you from? You're not American. I know you're not American. You're taking a valiant stab at a region dialect free American accent, but I know you're not American. Like, I just feel it in my gut. But I got in my head, I thought, Ireland. You've got that thing that Saoirse Ronan does sometimes, where you hear her and you go, I know it. You're not nailing this.
Every so often you catch a vowel. Yeah.
Someone wasn't listening well in this take because you did not nail it in that take. Because she's not just from Ireland. She's from like an Irish Spring commercial. Like, when she's on Ellen talking, just like, I can barely understand anything you're saying. You're like the butcher boy. Like, I need subtitles for you.
But she had a really good American accent from the jump. I mean, when she was 11.
No. She's really good at American accents, but every once in a while, she...
Little
vowels and things slip through, and you're thinking... Meh.
She'll open her mouth and a shillelagh will come out.
Oh, speaking of Ireland, we have a winner in the Patreon contest of who has the wildest address.
Right.
We have a new Dylan. Hey.
Hi, Dylan.
Hey, Dylan. Dylan lives in Ireland on streets that with names I cannot say.
That Google Maps aren't even quite sure.
And not because they're profane, because I can't pronounce them. Yeah. So I would love, Dylan, if you're listening to this episode, send us some kind of phonetic
or an audio file of
about your address, because I really want to hear how to say the names of all the words in your Patreon address, because it really is something. It's just beautiful, beautiful words. I have no idea how they're pronounced.
Patreon.com/linoleumknife.
Right. That's the commercial for our Patreon this week. Would you like other content, other podcasts? One about food, hosted by film critics. One about TV, hosted by film critics.
Who watch TV.
One about whatever, when we swear.
Yes, that
and
one.
And there's so many different things that you can get.
And cool prizes.
As a Patreon subscriber, why don't you go there, patreon.com/linoleumknife.
Join our club.
Yes.
So tell us about your two...
Blockers. Let's go Blockers.
Oh, Blockers. I forgot.
Blockers.
Wait, yes. Blockers is fun.
It's shocking.
You really...
I didn't want to go.
Oh, wow.
Well, you know how I am. I live in a bubble. I don't watch trailers if I can at all. If I can at all help it.
Right.
I don't watch a trailer.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, sometimes I have to because I'm just sitting right there, but... in the theater, and it's happening. I didn't know anything about Blockers. I didn't know who directed it. I didn't know who wrote it. And it turns out that's not really relevant anyway.
Not too much, no. It premiered at South by Southwest.
Which I don't go to and don't pay attention to. Right.
I put through April Wolf's review for The Wrap, so, you know, I don't get to be in your bubble.
Right.
I have to read other people's reviews sometimes.
And as we were driving to the theater, I said to you, why am I here? Why am I coming to this? This smells like every boring, terrible, anti-sex, teen sex comedy. Where, let me predict right now what's going to happen. These three guys, this is how bubbled I was. I didn't know it was about three girls. These three guys are going to chase getting laid, losing their virginities or whatever, and their parents are going to try to stop it, and here comes the end, and the boys, all three heterosexual, are going to learn lessons about how you shouldn't want to have sex anyway, the end. Points off before I even see it for having no queer characters, because we live in a post-Love, Simon world where now everything has to have a queer character. For the next 30 years, all mainstream American films, and all other films too, have to have one queer character with some agency just to balance the imbalance that's been happening for decades and decades and decades, where queer people have been systematically erased from existence by movies.
Well, you just had a bucket full of wrong and dumb.
So I get to this movie, and it's about three teenage girls.
It's directed by a woman.
It's about three teenage girls who are all best friends, and they feel like real best friends. Mm-hmm. They don't feel like they've just been thrown together in a script. They all want to get laid. They all want to lose their virginity in different ways and for different reasons. And one of them is a little lesbian.
Yes.
Stunning. Now, that premise makes it woke enough, but it's actually really funny.
Yeah.
And also a really funny movie about parental confusion and parental hypocrisy.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to give too many things away. There's some raunchy stuff in it, some gross out stuff in it,
yeah,
that feels
requisite,
and yes, that's the good word for it. Maybe a little shoehorned in.
Yeah.
But otherwise, all three adults, Leslie Mann, John Cena,
and
Ike Barinholtz, are great.
Yeah.
Ike Barinholtz is this stealth MVP pretty much wherever he goes.
Yeah.
He's the guy, when I walk into a movie and I see him, I go, oh, what's his name again? I did that for the first 15 minutes of this movie.
Oh, fine.
I was like, oh, it's that guy. And he's always really funny in this low-key kind of way.
Yeah.
And you kind of forget that he's out in the world when you're not watching him be a supporting player in someone else's movie. And about 20 minutes in, I was like, oh, Ike Barinholtz, I know who you are. But he really shines,
yeah,
in this. He's got, of all the parents, he's got the arciest arc, really.
I guess so, but I have to say, one of the things that I like about this movie is how much the parents have their own sort of story. It's not oh, the girls are interesting and conflicted over, and then there's the parents.
Right.
The parents have their own sort of like...
No, six people have six stories here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, the three parents in this were sort of thrown together by the fact that their daughters became best friends. They wouldn't necessarily have chosen each other in that way.
And they have their own conflicted friendship history.
And yeah, and like, the you know, it's like the, you know, their kids met in like kindergarten or first grade. Now it's senior year, it's prom night, they're about to graduate, and the three of them clearly are like not
always the best of pals.
Yes.
They're sort of like, oh, you again.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And they're sort of like, oh, I guess I have to be nice to you now. And it's, did you call me? Really? I didn't get that. So, so I thought their trajectory was as interesting as the girls were. There were really funny comic set pieces that I didn't often see coming. It's the kind of movie where I not only laughed consistently, but had some really big laughs periodically.
Just right.
Like really delighted, surprised kind of things. And all this and queer content. So it was, I was
and
very
cool.
Surprised.
Like, they do it all really well, and it's cool.
Yeah.
Like, there's nothing corny or embarrassing about the approach to this stuff.
Well, it's executive produced by Seth Rogen and you know, Evan Goldberg.
Yeah.
And, you know, they have, you know, when you look back at, like, Superbad, when you look at other stuff they've done, they're really smart about sex stuff. I mean, you know, they produced For a Good Time Call. So, you know, I think that over the years they have... They kind of interject these movies with a sensibility about sexuality and even teen sexuality that I think movies have been kind of skittish about before, but they're very like, no, this is a thing that happens and it's not the end of the world and it's not this horror show and like, let's let everybody calm down.
Yeah. Okay, so. There's a film that is called Good Luck. You're going to have to go do some digging on your own. No pun intended. Because it's about minors.
Hey. Does this have a distributor?
It...
Is it like Cinema Guild or something? Or is it just...
It opened just this past week, I believe, in New York in an actual like theatrical run.
Okay.
But as often is the case... no one in Los Angeles booked it, because of it. I guarantee you it's because of its subject matter. I'm going to tell you what it's about. Pretend I'm telling you what it's about for the first time.
Uh-huh.
Okay, so it's a 2.5-hour ethnographic documentary about copper miners in Serbia.
Mm-hmm.
And then, halfway through the movie... You move to Suriname, where there is an illegal gold mining site that incredibly poor men have just decided to take upon themselves. So it's about miners in two different hemispheres. And
there's no intercutting. It's one and then the other?
It's one and then the other. Mm-hmm. And it actually, you know, it begins, you know, part one, part two.
Ah.
You know. Do you want to go see that movie?
I would need more information.
Okay. What if I sweetened the deal by telling you that it's a long take kind of movie?
Oh!
Where the first 5 minutes are the backs of Serbian coal miners, copper miners, as they walk to work. And then the next 5 minutes is they get in the elevator and go down the shaft for like 5 minutes.
Did the Mon Kamana people make this movie?
And then the next, well, as I said, this is an ethnographic documentary that is very much in keeping with the kind of film that Mon Kamana is.
I see.
And like the other films from Harvard Sensory Ethnography Lab. So when the Serbian copper miners jackhammer into a wall, they do it for about 5 minutes. And I'm saying 5 minutes, 5 minutes, 5 minutes. I didn't count the timing.
In real time.
But this is a real time thing.
Okay, I have a question.
And so, okay, yes.
How do you know when these movies aren't good?
Well, the way you know when any movie is not good. Does it not hold your attention? Does it bore you? Does it feel disingenuous? Does it feel like an interloper has gone in and is, you know, stealing the souls of the people that he's shooting?
Right.
Or does it feel like, you know, a window into another person's life that you want to pay attention to because this has relevance to your world?
Okay. I just wonder sometimes what the aesthetic criteria here is, because...
Now, here's the thing. I'm not a film festival programmer who has to sit through, you know, 45 entries of this sort of thing and then pick the one that's good.
Right.
Now, you know, as a film festival programmer, what that's like.
Yes.
And so
you get all the handy pre-selected.
Someone else brought me this film called Good Luck.
Right.
From a director with a pedigree, a man named Ben Russell. He's made about 35 shorts and features. Mm-hmm. This was my first one from him. Now I want to go see what I can find of his other films.
I see.
I'll tell you, this, I believe, is one of the good ones.
Okay.
It is about, you know, first of all, just goofy stuff. You know, like I went with Matt, and I turned to Matt after the jackhammer scene, and I said, when you're jackhammering a hole into a wall and you're like 2 miles below the earth, when do you know that you're done? how do you know when you are finished jackhammering? Also, this sounds like a lot of records that I own.
I'm sure.
And on the way out, he goes, does it really sound like a lot of records you own? I said, oh yeah, it exactly sounds like a lot of records that I own, that jackhammer noise. But so here's what I really liked about this. First of all, if you're an American person in a big city going to a film festival to see a movie like this, and you have a home to go to when you're done, and you have a job that doesn't require that you go miles deep into the earth and submit yourself to actual danger, then you are really peering through a long tunnel. And you cannot leave a film like this and say, oh yes, now I understand all of it. You know, like, this is what, now I know what it's like for these people. Mm. Because you don't. But what it does hammer home the way more films should is the despicable nature of big capital's destructive influence on the lives of the people who are just parts in that machine.
Mm.
And it does so without being didactic, because all he does is talk to the miners about everyday kind of things. And they bring their own...
Oh, so there are interviews in this?
Kinda. Like, through a translator, someone will say, so, on a day-to-day basis, what are you afraid of? Mm. And they'll answer, they'll talk. Or someone will break out their accordion and start playing a song.
I wasn't sure if interviews were a no-no in an ethnographic film.
Well, this one is sort of a hybrid. When I say it's an ethnographic documentary, I mean that it is mostly that.
I see.
There's also some experimental qualities, mm-hmm, that it possesses, such as black and white sort of camera test footage of each miner. Hmm. And I really loved that, because what happens every 10, 15 minutes, one of the miners takes the camera, sits down, and allows the camera to point itself at his face for as long as he wants to sit there with it, so they control it. And a couple of them are like, they can't, they're trying not to laugh, and they put the camera away quickly because they're like, I don't want any part of this. And some of them will just hold the stare. And what that does, for me at least, is that it, in spite of the fact that the film is showing them do this work, you're not directly engaged with them, these guys. But when they're sitting there staring at you, you have no choice but to be engaged. Like, each person coming to that camera face first is, you know, an actual human being,
yeah,
who busts his ass every single day. Whether it's in Serbia or the guys in Suriname who are doing it in, you know, even more dire circumstances. Because in Serbia, at least, they have some EU protections for right. their job site. But these guys in Suriname are just renegade freewheeling, like, I'm just going to go find some gold. Mm. Of course, they never find any gold. Oh. And they're never shown finding any gold. They're just sort of...
Are they, like, panning?
Panning. They're panning, yeah. Mm. Which, I don't know what... modern gold extraction techniques are, but I guarantee you it's not gold rush panning. It can't be, right?
I would imagine yeah. there's something more sophisticated to it, but yeah. It may be that panning is how they find the site, and then once they find the site, then they bring in the bigger equipment.
I don't know. In any case, this is really good. Mm. And if you are the kind of person, I don't want to make it sound like it's experimental in a way that is difficult to understand, because it is not. You and I had this discussion after I came home Friday night. It's the kind of movie that you could deal with because narratively it isn't opaque. It's not
abstract.
It's not going off in a direction and expecting you to figure it out.
Right.
It presents everything it wants to present to you. It's the duration. You know, you're going to sit there for minutes at a time watching the backs of people as they walk into work. Mm-hmm. You know, you're going to sit there watching people just pan for gold or sit around a fire and talk about superstitions about the land. Mm-hmm. You know, in Suriname, the guys say things like, if you spill blood on this ground, you have to pick up and leave. You know, the earth wants you to pay a price, and if you don't, you know, it's all this very spooky ghost story kind of stuff where I'm thinking, okay, well, this is something religious that I don't understand, but that's fine. But they have a much more sort of fraught religious relationship with their actual physical environment than the guys in Serbia do. But in any case, this is, you know, this is a remarkable film. Look for it. I don't know where it's going to be. I'm guessing film festivals, museums. It was one night at the Los Angeles Downtown Independent.
College.
Acropolis Cinema. These guys here in town who are doing such a good job bringing this kind of stuff to Los Angeles when it otherwise is not booked. Even if it's only one night. I've now come to a place with Acropolis where if they've got something and it's on a Tuesday, I think, okay, I'm going. I'm going to take a late nap in the afternoon and I'm going. I don't care. Because by, you know, Friday night, this thing started at 8 o'clock and I was like, oh, I'm going to doze off.
Yeah, everything. Good luck staying awake.
Yeah, but I did. I took a nice long nap beforehand. Also, I met someone who listens to the show there.
Oh, right.
Yeah, a dude named Robert, who, it's always so funny when I'm out in the world, I'm just sort of like, you know. I go pick up a ticket, and there's this dude, got a beard, he's smiling at me. And I was like, in my head, I saw him smiling at me. I was looking at him, looked up at him like three times, and each time he's smiling at me. And I was like, do I know you? Are you from the Bears? Like, you know, he's got a beard, and I'm thinking, like, I meet you at some bear pool party or something. Like, do I know you? And I'm thinking, nah, I don't know you. So I just walked in, but then he walked in and found me. He's like, are you Dave White? And I was like, yes. He was like, I listened to the show. And I was, here's the thing. If you see me out in the world in Los Angeles and you listen to this show and you want to come up and tell me that you listen to the show, please do. Because it, first of all, thrills me. Secondly, shocks the hell out of me, because invariably my first thought, and my first thought with him was when he said he listened to the show, was, how did you hear that we existed? Like, because it's not like we're anything. It's not like we're a big deal. In the world of podcasts, we are tiny, tiny, tiny. And I'm always surprised that anyone knows we exist, honestly. So I was very happy.
We love our listeners and take none of you for granted.
Nope. Thank you. And so, you know, if you see me out, come say, hey, I know you. You don't know me. I listen to your podcast because it'll make me very happy.
Yeah. No, I always love that when that happens.
Yeah. And it always surprises me, shocks me every time. I don't know. Maybe I shouldn't be so shocked. I don't know.
It's been going on 8 years.
Seven and a half years.
Yeah.
But still, though, I mean, we grew from nothing to a small thing.
True.
We're still a small thing.
One tiny acorn.
Right.
So you also saw Claire's Camera.
Claire's Camera, which is the opposite of Good Luck. It is the new film from Hong Sang-soo, and it is a quickie.
Is he still airing his dirty laundry?
Oh, yeah. oh, my. What a confessional dude he is without being confessional. That's the funny thing about his movies. This one stars Kim Min-hee. Perhaps you know her from
The Handmaiden.
The Handmaiden, or from other Hong Sang-soo movies in which she has recently been playing the woman that he has an affair with. Oh, guess what? In real life, he had an affair with her, and it was a big scandal in Korea, and his own wife refuses to grant him a divorce. And so now, after confessing to their affair at a film festival, they've broken off their relationship.
But they're still making movies.
Most recently, they've broken off their relationship. But they're still making movies together about this affair. Like, On the Beach at Night Alone was about this affair. And this one is sort of the same thing. It was shot at the Cannes Film Festival. And it is literally 69 minutes long with credits. Speaking of tiny little acorns, it is a tiny little thing where the characters, Kim Min-hee and most otherwise well-known, Isabelle Huppert.
Yeah.
And other, you know, Korean actors all engage in 69 minutes of small talk. And the reason they do this is because they keep crisscrossing into each other's lives without intending to, and also without really wanting to. Mm-hmm. All kind of bound together by Claire, who is played by Isabelle Huppert, and her tourist camera. So she takes pictures of people, and she's like, oh, look, oh, you know this person whose picture I just took? Oh, yes, I'm having an affair with this person. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know he was married. Oh, isn't that great? Well, because we only speak English in common, let's have a stilted conversation about food. Seriously, all the conversations in the movie are this. Do you like to eat Korean food? Oh, well, I don't know if I like to eat Korean food. I have never tried it. Why don't we go eat Korean food? Cut to them eating Korean food. I like this food quite a bit. Here's a picture I took of the man that you're banging. Like, and then the conversation is like, oh, yes, I think I know him. Like, it is such a weird little movie where chatter stands in for everything else.
So Isabelle Huppert is playing a tourist at the Cannes Film Festival.
Uh-huh. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. She's a teacher. She's just never gone to Cannes, and she's there taking pictures of people. Just wandering around, accidentally, we think, you know, running. Like, half the movie, I thought, is she a private investigator who's just super obvious about it? Like,
I'm hiding in plain sight.
Right. And then it ends abruptly.
Hmm.
It ends abruptly, but it does end with an ending.
Right.
You know, it's a story that has a beginning and a middle and an end.
Yes.
But it ends so abruptly and so quickly at the point in a film where most people are just getting settled into the narrative.
Hmm.
Let me tell you, the audience at the Beverly Hills Lindley Music Hall, all of whom make me look like a millennial. All right.
And I bet they just like, oh, it's a new Isabella Huppert movie.
Oh, yeah. Like, I couldn't have been, I was the youngest person there.
Yes.
Well, no, because, you know, Robbie was with me, and he's an actual millennial. But the, these 75-year-old people, and the theater was, you know, not empty. Mm-hmm. It was, there was a good crowd there. A little house, but.
Yeah.
The disgruntled statements and sighs and, huh, what was that? You know. Because you walk in it, these are all neighborhood folks.
Uh-huh.
Just walking in, ooh, the new Isabelle Huppert film. I can't wait. I love that Isabelle Huppert.
Yeah, there's this thing about, like, aging cineasts, you know.
They are grumpy.
They're testy, but they will very predictably turn up for anything with, like, Catherine Deneuve or Isabelle Huppert.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, they were not having this at all.
I bet they probably were also grumpy at the end of, what was the movie that Isabelle Huppert just did with Michael Haneke?
Well.
Oh, Happy End.
Happy End. Yeah. And then, of course.
Piano Teacher. I was thinking about Happy End, though.
Yeah, Happy End. Happy End, though, as, you know, difficult, you know, to deal with as it was. That has a
conclusion.
That has the shape of. A film that you recognize.
Right.
You know, a French film that you recognize. This does not.
Right.
And he, Hong Sang-soo, is the guy who, well, his people talk around things.
Right.
So I really enjoyed it. I really liked this a lot.
Now, could you...
And you can watch it in a blink.
Would you recommend it to people who are walking in on their first Hong Sang-soo movie? No. Or do they need to see On the Beach
Alone? Why don't you see On the Beach at Night Alone or... Right Then, Wrong Now. Is that what it's called? I always get the name of that one mixed up. Yeah. Go with an earlier... On the Beach at Night Alone.
Okay.
That's a great one. And it's about, you know, it's about the affair. Hmm. So, yeah. But this one, it's right on. And Kim Min-hee is... so able to erase herself in ways that you don't expect actors to do. She can just be very frail and quiet and seemingly timid, of course, and then she unleashes something, you know, big and angry, but it's always a shock when she does it. I dig her. Anyway.
DVD pick this week?
Recently dropping on Filmstruck.
Mm-hmm.
23 films by Jean Painlevé. He was the French scientist and filmmaker who made nature films.
Mm-hmm.
Most of them quite short, but gorgeously weird and surreal, and just sort of trippy visual.
What era? Stuff.
Early. He was, you know, born in 1902.
Oh, I see.
Okay. Yeah. And so the most well-known ones, the ones you see, you know, frame grabs of, are like the films about seahorses. And they are astonishing. You used to be able to see some of them on YouTube, but I bet they've all been scrubbed by YouTube. Criterion Collection put out all 23 in a set.
Okay.
And all of them are on Filmstruck now.
Oh,
and right. They're so great.
Cool.
Yeah.
Mine is Gillian Armstrong's The Last Days of Xenu, which is now streaming on Netflix. It has been hard to track down lately, but it is, I think, one of her, you know, strongest films. It's about kind of a marriage imploding, basically. It stars.
Is it because one marriage partner didn't bring the other a sandwich?
I'm sure that was definitely one of the straws that broke the camel's back there, because, you know, there's just no bouncing back from that. It stars Bruno Gans, and I'm trying to remember now who the women in it are. Carrie Fox and Miranda Otto. Like, it's your Australian all-stars here. And Bill Hunter's in it, too. It's just a really... it's funny, but it's also, you know, kind of heartbreaking. And Armstrong, I think, you know, she operates so well in so many genres, and we think of her as sort of like these, you know, my brilliant career being this period piece, and Starstruck right. being this larger than life musical. But this is a really kind of focused, eccentric, you know, just sort of personal drama, and really beautifully done. And I think it's been kind of hard to see in the U.S. lately, so that it's. My friend Maria, who works at Filmstruck, actually tweeted about the fact that Starstruck and something else are on Filmstruck, two films. Mrs. Sofel are both available on Filmstruck.
I've never seen Mrs. Sofel.
Oh, it's great.
Is it?
Yeah. All it's right. like Mel Gibson when he was still like young and hot and not a complete, and not a, you know, goon.
Turd.
And Diane Keaton, and they have really great chemistry together.
Right.
So those two are on Filmstruck, and then Netflix has Last Days of Shenu, the 1994 Little Women, mm-hmm. and the documentary Women He's Undressed.
Yes.
And then somebody else on Facebook.
The one where Cary Grant is mean to Ori Kelly.
Exactly.
Damn.
And
then,
and someone on Facebook pointed out to me that if you get Canopy, they've got My Brilliant Career. So there's lots of Julian
Armstrong.
You can
get Canopy if you got a Los Angeles Public Library card.
Yeah, not all library systems are hooked into Canopy, but if yours is, it's an amazing resource. It's got almost like the entire Criterion collection, a lot of the Kino Lorber Library, Canopy with a K, KNOPY.com. But anyway, there's a lot of streaming Julian Armstrong. She's one of my favorite filmmakers. If you are trying to get more female filmmakers into your diet, she's a great place to start. I think she's wonderful.
Alfonso.
Yes, thanks, A24, for blurbing me on your ad for Lean on Pete, taking my words not exactly out of context, but making them sound sappier than they were meant to, and calling me Alfonso.
Not that there's anything wrong with the name Alfonso.
There isn't. It's just not mine.
It just so happens that Alfonso...
Oh, Alfonso, our listener.
Our listener has sent in a question.
Okay.
I haven't heard this mentioned elsewhere, but as much as I loved Black Panther, I think they missed an opportunity. Rather than Martin Freeman's character, they could have had Terrence Howard, representing pro-establishment African-Americans, and an interesting tri-part discussion could have been had between him, Michael B. Jordan's Revolution, and Chadwick Boseman's Third Way. I realized that this would have meant that the only white character would be a villain, but I'm fine with that. What do you think?
Well, that's a possibility, but there's a couple of things. First of all, the Martin Freeman character had been introduced in one of the other MCU movies, and he's the only connective tissue, really. Well, except for, I guess, the fact that we had seen the villain, the character played by Andy Serkis in Age of Ultron. But anyway, the Martin Freeman character was there as a connective tissue for the MCU. And I think also the movie kind of intentionally wanted that role to be sort of the token white guy, basically giving a white actor the kind of role that a black actor usually gets relegated in a movie like this.
Yes.
And as far as Terrence Howard specifically, I think there's probably still bad blood over the fact that he got canned from Iron Man and replaced with Don Cheadle. You'll recall he was the original Rhodey back in the first Iron Man movie, so I don't think they're going to catch him with a 10-foot pole. But... yes, on paper, certainly this is an interesting idea. I don't know that there was room for any more ideas in Black Panther. It's already got they're already spinning a lot of plates.
We're full of ideas already. Full up.
Yes. No more, thanks.
Right. This is from Phil. He is referring... Phil's letter is referring to the episode we did with... Matt and Jillian from the All Things Cozy podcast, where they came to our home and talked about cozy movies.
Yes.
So Phil wants to talk about cozy movies.
Okay.
Any Pride and Prejudice iteration gives me the cozies.
Well, sure.
Thinking about it, almost all the British films, Howard's End, Gosford Park, Morris, Remains of the Day, well, not the British films, really, but the Merchant Ivory films.
Well, or
and
or
all period,
films of that period.
Period, you know, dramas, yeah. All of those centuries-old cottages and castles, low ceilings or manor halls, they all feel cozy. A couple of my favorite cozy scenes in movies were any of Kate Winslet's cottage in The Holiday. Oh, God, yes.
Yeah.
Like, she might as well be Winnie the Pooh living in the honey tree. Like, it's that adorable, her
Wait,
little place.
You mean Cameron Diaz in Kate Winslet's cottage? Because Kate Winslet's in L.A.
Right, but not at the beginning of the movie.
Oh, that's true. Okay, yeah. Yes.
And the opening smooth jazz with Cat Tuna Plate. Finishing the book celebration in Romancing the Stone. My personal go-to cozy movies, which I'll watch yearly, Cold Comfort Farm.
Yes.
Despite the ramshackle ankle-deep mud and rustiness of the place. Scent of Green Papaya, despite Ooh. The overwhelming sense of humidity, heat, and mosquitoes.
I hadn't thought of that one as cozy, but I do love that movie.
And especially while you were sleeping, which makes even walking along the Chicago River at night in winter look cozy.
I'm going to venture to say that you probably wouldn't find Pride and Prejudice and Zombies all that cozy.
Yeah, probably not. We have 5-star reviews.
Hooray!
Would you like to leave us one? Go do it on the, what's it called? iTunes?
Apple Podcasts.
It's no longer called iTunes. It's called
Apple Podcasts.
Apple Podcasts.
Or wherever you listen to the show.
If and you got an idea that you want to leave a 4 or 3-star review or anything worse, you just get out. You go away.
Put your ideas in your pocket.
You run away and leave us alone. Because we don't like it. You leave us a 5-star. Then we're friends.
Like?
Such as 3 friends from USA. Oh, no, 3 friends. That's the name of the person.
Yes.
I first discovered the show several years ago when Dave and Alonzo were guests on the Team Jack podcast.
Ooh, that was a while ago.
Let me tell you something. I had forgotten that we were ever on the Team Jack podcast. I haven't forgotten about Jack.
No.
We still like Jack quite a bit, but I forgot that he had a podcast and that we were on it. They were guests on Team Jack, and I have never looked back. Year after year, Linoleum Knife has consistently been the best podcast for first-run movie reviews. The atmosphere is loaded with great humor and genuine warmth, and films are approached from thought-provoking angles with respect for the art form, whether the brow be high or low.
Well,
where else am I going to hear reviews of Death Wish and Elmar Lamar in the same episode? Where else am I going to get a review of Elmar Lamar, period? Thank you.
Thanks.
Gray Cloud 9 says, David Alonzo are delightful. Even when my life gets busy, I never miss an episode since I discovered them last year. They're insightful, intelligent film critics with great banter. Whenever I listen to a new episode, I feel like I'm catching up with my favorite podcasting married gay couple. Well, how many other podcasting married gay couples are there? I'm sure there are some out there.
Yeah.
But are they film critics? Nope. That's us. J112233445566778.
No one's going to steal that name.
Says, as someone who studies film, I always enjoy finding podcasts where experts, that's us, dig deep from angles I may not have otherwise thought of. Dave and Alonzo are a lovely married couple who are both longtime film critics. Their podcast is entertaining, an entertaining discussion of films both new and old, and their passion and knowledge come through with every sentence. Every sentence, including ones like this. Why don't you bring me a sandwich?
There's insight in there.
Jeez, John.
No, we read that one already.
We did?
Yeah, the first three are the new ones. The other two we've read before.
I forget everything I say the minute I finish saying it. Okay.
Thank you, everybody, for leaving the 5-star reviews. We appreciate it. It does help people find the show. Hey, once again, join our club, patreon.com/linoleum.
Hey, now.
I'm just saying the URL again. Right. Get off my back.
All right.
Patreon.com/linoleumknife.
Shh. Don't bother people so much.
You're bothering me. And you didn't bring me a sandwich. So you just watch us. Go to ChristyLemire.com. Check out Cancel Too Soon and Critically Acclaimed, hosted by Bibbs and Whitney. The latter show is available on the Schmoes Know Network. Check out all those wonderful Schmoes Know shows. And Anyone with Dennis Hensley, Super Gay, All Things Cozy, The Comics Canon, Fat Guys of the Movies, Sewers of Paris, The Criterion Cast, Film Spotting SVU, and Secretly Timid. You can, of course, subscribe to the show at Apple Podcasts, and that's where you ought to leave us those 5-star reviews. You can also leave us positive feedback in all the places that we stream, like Stitcher Radio, TheLounge.com, Spotify, Podbean, CastBox, all the places. You can follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at LinoleumCast. Drop us a line at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com with questions or comments. And, of course, there's always patreon.com/linoleumlife. Anyway, until next time.
You better don't.
It's been great to have you with us, and we'll catch you when we're back.
You know what's funny?
What's funny?
We started this recording, and it was, like, perfectly bright, and the sun was out.
Mm-hmm.
And we finished this recording.
We're practically in the dark.
The sun was set, and we're sitting in near pitch darkness because we haven't gotten up to turn on any lights.
Well, I tried to open the shade midway through the show, and the sun was still
shining in your face.
Eyes, yes,
but it's weird to be sitting here in like the total darkness, and the only way I can even really see your face is that your laptop screen is like shining on it.
We're going to bring the mood down a little bit now.
Well, no, we're not. We're going to bring the mood over. The mood is done. All right. We're done with the mood because we're done.
We're done here.
But was there something else I had forgot that I needed to say?
I have no idea.
I guess not.
Okay, then. So this is where you say...
Goodbye.